Blog Talk Radio.
This is Jasa Sagonige, a 7th grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evenings and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's the 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. Folks, the scriptures say my people perish for lack of knowledge. We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you. Prophecy Keepers does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look. OCO, Ginalii, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation.
Well, everybody, this is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from Booger County in the mysterious Ozarks in Mid-America. And our special fantastic guest this week is Brooks Agnew from ArcOfMillionsOfYears.com. New discoveries and light on the creation. We're going to be talking about the Nephilim. And welcome, Dr. Agnew.
Thank you very much, Blue Water.
Hey, you bet. We loved your show on Coast to Coast and gave it a shot, and appreciate you coming on Prophecy Keepers. So you're in Arlington, Texas right now, right?
Yes, I'm in Arlington, Texas right now.
So what's been going on in your life lately?
Well, we are working on Volume 2 of The Ark of Millions of Years. When we originally submitted our book to the publisher, it was around 750 pages, and basically they said, too big, can't print it. So
yeah.
We took a couple hundred pages out of the book, and it made a good basis for a second volume. Basically, we shut off the timeline at the present, and so the next volume will take us from the present to the future.
Excellent. So I know recently we had another guest that discussed this. This is a really hot topic about the Nephilim, but you've got some other things to talk about. I love your idea that this Earth may actually be the Ark, and that the biblical story that's been presented to us it may also be true, it may also be allegorical. And we don't run this. I when you were on Coast, I'm sure you guys ran on a script. You talked for 3 hours, but we run this show with the seat of our pants, We want you to go ahead and talk about, lead us wherever you want to go on this interview, Dr. Brooks.
Oh, that's all right. One of the things I'd like to say is that none of my interviews are scripted.
Oh, is that right? I figured Coast, everything's scripted.
No, we were just actually able to speak for 3 hours extemporaneously on the subjects covered by the book, and it was as fascinating for me as it was for them, I guess.
Yeah, it's a fun subject. And tell us about... Tell us about the concept that the Earth may have come through a black hole, and that the Earth itself may be an arc that came across a cosmic sea, and tell us about the Nephilim.
All right. As a physicist, what I've done for the last 20 years is try to study the spectroscopy of creation. I guess that's what we all do, but physicists are like the ancient prophets. We just look into the heavens with the best skill and the best instruments that we have, and when we do that, we're looking at the past, and it's billions and billions of years of past, because it takes that long for the light from those stars or galaxies to reach us.
Sounds familiar. Billions and billions.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. What our mathematicians and those of us with great imaginations in the science of physics do is we try to imagine about the way matter is pulling on itself across the universe, and our observations indicate that that the forces that are at work in the universe indicate that there's a lot more matter, there's a lot more force than what we have evidence for.
Uh-huh.
And Einstein and Rosen sort of got together and laid the mathematical groundwork for a gravitational body that really not until the 1960s was termed a black hole. And a black hole is a collapsed star or a collapsed gravitational pinpoint, if you will, in space where the gravity is so intense that light itself cannot escape that area, and so it doesn't give off any light. It's just dark to an outside observer. Unfortunately, we have never directly observed a black hole. We can observe its gravitational effects on those bodies around it. We can see, for instance, gases being stripped off of a star and sucked down into a, a tornado-like hole in the galaxy or in the universe, but we can't actually see the black hole itself. We've built a series of observatories called LIGO or LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatories, and we're trying our best to detect these very, very weak rhythmic signals that come off of rotating black holes or coalescing black holes or even birthing black holes, but so far we've not been successful. Theoretically, we think we will eventually find them. The trick is making a measuring device that's sensitive enough to pick those waves up without picking up all the other noise the planet likes to make. And so that's the challenge. But nevertheless, theory builds upon theory, and we have pretty much irrefutably decided that black holes exist. Now, their characteristics are at a great subject of argument in our science. But here is what we have done in the book. We have approached black holes from the standpoint that we believe that they are spinning at their maximum speed. And let me just break that down a little bit. Our star revolves on its axis just like our Earth does. We can see the sunspots going across the surface of it. We know pretty much how long it takes for a sun to revolve on its axis. We know the size of it. We pretty much know the age of it based on the species of hydrogen wavelength that it puts off. As the sun burns out over time, it loses its eruptive force, and gravity takes over, and the sun begins to shrink in size. As it does, much like an ice skater pulling her arms in, it spins faster. It's called conservation of momentum, one of the nice Newtonian laws that we rely upon. As the star collapses to, say, 1/10,000th its original size, that ratio of spin reaches a point where it's spinning quite quickly. We see this when we see coalescing neutron stars. These are two neutron stars, dead stars that are coming together. And they don't come together head on. They sort of come together like two ice skaters grabbing hands and then spinning around each other.
Right. I was just going to mention that for folks so they could get some idea of what you're talking about.
Right. And when we say coalescing, we mean that they've grabbed hands and they're revolving around each other and they're eventually going to spin into a single point. That coalescing, that spinning, can reach a frequency of about 3,000 cycles a second. That's really, really fast for heavenly bodies. Well, when they do that, they make ripples in space-time. They make gravitational waves that we can pick up with radio telescopes. We've learned over the last 25 years seriously to map these binary neutron stars all over our galaxy and even other galaxies. And they become a quite reliable navigational tool. And we can even see them coalesce. They make a tremendous ripple like throwing a boulder into a pond across space-time when they do collide. We believe that these are precursors, little baby pinpoints that begin black holes. It takes a solar mass of at least 1.4 times our sun to create a black hole. It's pretty solid evidence based on the gravitational pull at the center of the galaxy that there is a large black hole at the center of every galaxy. It may be the gravity engine that actually lights up all the stars in that galaxy. So, assuming pretty solidly that spin does exist, what we realize is that spinning black holes don't stay round like a basketball. They flatten out like a hula hoop. And so on the inside of this, what we call an event horizon, that's the point of no return for light. Light tries to escape, but the gravitational pull is too much. One of the things we know about gravity is that it decreases at the square of the distance away from the body that you are. In other words, the further away you get from Earth, the less likely you are to fall to Earth.
Uh-huh.
okay, based on that mathematical relationship. So this event horizon is sort of like a membrane. Inside the membrane, you cannot get out. Outside the membrane, you cannot see in, because nothing is radiating out to you from the hole. However, now that and there's another scientist named Dr. Kerr, K-E-R-R, that agreed with this, that these black holes actually form what's known as an accretion disk, this hula hoop idea. 99% of the matter of that black hole exists in the tube of the hoop, but across the center of the hoop, it's pretty much empty. There's no matter. There's nothing with which to collide. However, the hoop, if held up like a looking glass, would be the same as looking down the eye of a tornado or a wormhole. Now, to give you an idea of the diameter across this hoop, it's not a pinpoint. It could be as much as 400 times the diameter of our solar system. So if you took the orbital diameter of Pluto and you multiplied it by 400 times, this might be the open window that this black hole forms in space-time. So a body, a ship, a planet, whatever, that would pass through the center of this gravitational warp would not suffer the tidal gravity that you see in the movies, where something is pulled apart and yanked into the black hole like sending an entire body through a hole in a barrel. It would pretty much suffer no tidal gravity effects whatsoever, but it would pass across large spaces in the cosmos, either across a universe or from universe to universe or from dimension to dimension. And that Earth probably, or that planet or that traveler or that spaceship, would not age very much relative to itself. It would just age at its normal rate. But relative to everything outside that hoop, everything outside that hoop would age tremendously. So when we say that the Earth is both 7,000 years old and 4.5 billion years old, what we are talking about are the two Earths, one created spiritually, one created physically. Upon one Earth there is man and woman. Upon the other Earth there is Adam and Eve, up all the way to Noah. The spiritual Earth went through this black hole window formed, traveled across immense distances of space, and then merged with the physical Earth in the orbit where we are right now. The two races, Noah's race and the race of man and woman that were here on the Earth at the time, came together. Their DNA blended, their lifespans, their resistance to disease, their intelligence, everything blended, and we are the descendants of that merging. We call it the union of the polarity.
Very interesting. So, that's something. So, well, you know, Scripture pretty well points out that everything was created spiritually before it was created materially. So, I mean, that's not anything that's far fetched. That's at least scripturally, that's provable.
Sure, in the Bible, it's left in there. It's
maybe it's in Psalms.
Cryptic enough that I guess the people that originally tried to cleanse references to descendancy further than this mortality didn't see it. But there are other documents like the Zohar, portions of the Kabbalah, the Sefer Yetzirah, that talk extensively upon this merging of the polarity. On the cover of the book, you'll see, well, some people ask us, gee, isn't that the Star of David? And we say, yes, that is the Star of David, but you have to realize where the Star of David came from. Before David, before the star, there was this concept passed down from the original occupants from whom we descended, that there was a merging of this polarity, that there was a physical and a spiritual that came together. This is the symbol of the Star of David.
Yeah, it's the kingdom of God coming down from heaven two pyramids, one coming down and superimposing itself over the pyramid, you know, representing you know, what we live in.
Right. And one of the things that's unique about man as an animal, I guess, or as a species upon this planet, is that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that we're the only sentient beings on the planet. That, you know, we're not hunter-gatherers. We have a much further imagination and appreciation for things greater than ourselves. And we realize, and we try to state this as boldly as we can in the book, that we are actually spiritual beings having a mortal experience.
Uh-huh, sure.
Those of us that realize that can, I believe, and we really try to make this claim as much as we can in the book, we can transcend this hunter-gatherer or predator instinct that we have, and we can become, in mortality, this spiritual being, whereby we care about every living thing. We care about growing beyond this 100-year mortality that we have.
Well, instead of being hunter, we can become the prey. The one of the symbols of the people of Israel is the deer. So, you know, they're pretty much have been preyed upon for quite a while. So there's a little symbol
preyed
of...
Preyed upon by whom? Or by what?
Osiel.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of WiseFoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies. Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain. Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfast and 10 delicious dinner entrees from wisefoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water, and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year supply from wisefoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingraham, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why.
Just a lot, well, probably themselves in some measure.
Well,
but,
we introduced the Nephilim in the book.
Mm-hmm.
That not only are we not alone in the universe, but we are not alone on this planet and have not been, not on either planet, the spirit planet or the temporal planet, since the beginning.
Now that's pretty clear. That's pretty clear. So, the Nephilim, it's really interesting. It's not real clear in the Bible, why they're here with us. It's pretty clear from, especially if you read Torah, which I do, the idea of imps and demons and so forth, pretty much an overlay of Hellenist Roman mythology and pagan mythology. But originally, Ha-Satan, the person that we know as Satan, was a created being that was actually in the employ of Hashem. And this guy had a job, and his job was to test us. So,
before that, his job was the light bringer.
Yeah, correct, Lucifer. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but this guy was supposedly a spirit being. How did these corporeal beings? This is the thing I've always wondered. How do these guys get bodies? Are they people like us that progress further than we did into space travel and so forth, and then made an unauthorized venture away from their domain?
Well, I think what's pretty clear from the documents we've been able to read, and I'm talking about the Book of Enoch, or also the Sefer Yetzirah, or the Kabbalah, is that the Nephilim, yes, were highly advanced, more aged creations than we were, or we are, and that they crossed the line, and they didn't travel away, they were cast out. And the documents pretty clearly correlate with one with another, that they were cast down. And so
the war in heaven wasn't a spiritual war, the one-third. So these, well, maybe it probably went on both in spirit and in physical. I guess everybody assumes that this all went on in the spirit world, but it looks like there was a physical component, and because everything's created spiritually before it's created physically. So they're the physical component of the Lucifer rebellion, apparently.
Well, and without going, too much into cyclic eternity, there are mentions of more than one eternity. There's mentions of more than one creation.
Sure.
Evidently, these 200 or so angels that were cast down did have physical bodies, did have great aptitude and intelligence, and they did exist here on the earth, and their mission was not to be benefactors to either creation, the spiritual or the temporal, but their mission was to corrupt. And they did their job so effectively, by the time Noah was mature, the earth was ripe for destruction. Oh. That there was just no way to salvage the people that were on the planet at that time. The institutions that had been established by the Creator were so corrupted they just could not be recovered. And Noah tried. He tried to find righteous people to go with him on the ark. And those that were schooled by the Nephilim, or the Nephilim themselves, or their offspring, we know them as giants, were so intelligent that when Noah discussed a flood, they pretty much said, gee, we're engineers, we're intergalactic travelers, we know what we're talking about, we're not scared of a flood. We can go to higher ground, we can build boats, we can fly, there's all kinds of things that we can do. What they, I guess, didn't anticipate is that it would be a universal, actually global flood from which there would not be any survival, unless you were either protected by the ark or you were off-planet, which, of course, the Nephilim had the ability to do.
Right.
Could they take 100,000 giants with them? No. I'd say the giants perished in that. But the Nephilim, of course, survived.
Well,
and they returned.
According to my just beginning to read into Hebrew lore, before Adam and Eve made their mistake, Adam was about 60 feet tall.
It makes sense. It's difficult to know. The bones of Adam were actually preserved on the ark. There was a fear that the graves would be desecrated by the flood, so the bones of Adam and Eve were actually reposed on the ark, and once the ark settled, they were reburied. And it's fair custom now in Israel that the bones of Adam and Eve are reposed in a cave in Hebron. If they were 60 feet long, I think that would be quite remarkable.
Well, they after this, of course, the Hebrews don't have a concept of the fall as far as original sin. But after they were cast out of the Garden of Eden, then they lost that stature, so they wouldn't be that tall now.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, that if they were originally that tall before they were cast out of the Garden of Eden, then so the idea that their Nephilim counterparts being giants isn't so far-fetched.
Right, right. And we don't really know what the stature of the Nephilim are, because we don't have any anything except for drawings and pictures and legends about them. But we do know that their DNA was rather universal, that it, unlike ours, could blend with any living thing. And so there were aberrations of offspring from the Nephilim. But one of the things they were enamored with were mortal women. And they were especially enamored with the long hair of beautiful earthly women. And so the tradition of the one pure race, which would be the Hebrew race or the Jew race, who decided that they would not marry or commingle with any other race other than their own. And to this day, their DNA is quite different than the general population. But they would also cover the head. So the tradition of covering the hair of a woman that they might not tempt the angels was recorded in the scriptures.
Yeah, that's the reason why Mennonite and Amish women to this day keep their heads covered.
And Catholic women in church.
It's true. And other people, Orthodox people, Abrahamic people do also.
Correct.
Fascinating. So don't stop there. Keep going.
All right. Well, the Nephilim's mission was to corrupt the earth. And the earth, after the union of the polarity, the Nephilim returned. Now, 200 Nephilim can't very effectively just run for political office or be heralded as gods and keep carrying on from generation to generation. So their methodology changed, and they began working with only the leaders, or sponsoring leadership, as it were. And we do have lots of ancient drawings of the Nephilim, winged and unwinged, standing behind kings, ostensibly putting words in their ear or giving them tactics or teaching them advanced methods of economics and political leadership, that they might, with only 200, be able to subdue several billion occupants of the earth and lead them down a path of idolatry, or at least away from the Creator, and maybe even convince them to destroy themselves, which it looks like, looking at ancient civilizations such as Atlantis and Mu and maybe others, that they've been successful in bringing advanced mortal civilizations to the brink of war and then convincing them to destroy each other.
Well, I can't remember who it was and when I heard this, it started to make a lot of sense, but I don't know if it was you or some of our other friends, but the concept that they have double row of teeth, when I heard
that... Well, it's not a concept. We've actually dug up the many, many thousands of graves where they have multiple rows of teeth, six fingers and toes. They range in size from 8 feet to 36 feet. Of course, a 36-footer can't survive very well on this planet. 8-footers have a hard time surviving on this planet. And they don't age the same as normal humans. They age.
Yeah.
You know, we get rheumatoid arthritis and humped over a little slow, but
yeah.
we can live with dignity all the way up to the age 100. Giants would become paralyzed from the waist down, or they would lose the use of their arms, and their great pride and extreme intelligence, their brains were about twice the size of ours, would cause them to go insane, and they would commit suicide. And
yeah.
There's all kinds of records, not just in the Bible, but in other books, where the giants committed suicide rather than face a life of invalidism.
Well, my friend Robert Three Eagles grew up in southern Utah around Kanab.
Oh.
And he's the fellow that's worked with Robert Ghostwolf and led him to a lot of the red-haired mummies that they photographed. But Robert, when he was when he was younger, he was raised by, his mother married one of the polygamists in southern Utah. And he and his brother weren't being fed too well, so back before it was illegal, they dug up quite a few on Anasazi sites. And he remembers running across skulls that had double rows of teeth. And he had an experience, and by the way, you can look him up, Google search Robert Three Eagles. He wrote a book called The Search for Knowledge and Unsolved Mysteries. But years ago, it's been about 92, Robert told me of an incident that he had, and as I recall this correctly, he was walking somewhere in the desert, walked up into a little draw, and his attention was grabbed by some kind of an animal that disappeared. So he went to look to find out where the animal had gone and felt cool air, which is a sure sign of a cave. Found his way into a cave, and the cave was apparently led to a complex of underground rooms. And in the rooms, he said there was something like a control panel up on the wall, and there were two, I think he said they were transparent tubes, and there was two bodies, one male, one female. I think he said one was 12 foot and the other was 8 foot, but that sounds like what he found. And but later on, when I was reading the book, The White Roots of Peace, which is the authorized history of the Six Nations, I found out that the name Daganoweda, or the peacemaker, the man or the being who paddled a stone canoe in from the north and stopped the blood feuds between the Six Nations Iroquois people, the name Daganoweda means double row of teeth. And so all of a sudden it struck me, the United States Constitution may, since it was derived from the Six Nations Iroquois League's Constitution, we may owe the United States Constitution to a Nephilim.
Well, it makes perfect sense. I don't know if it was a Nephilim or a descendant of Nephilim.
Mm-hmm.
The Nephilim are immortal.
Right.
But they're first generation and even second generation offspring, many of them did rebel against the leadership of the Nephilim, although they genetically were quite a bit different than the rest of the race. They still had freedom of choice. That's one of the human inheritances that we have. There's strong evidence of this if you look through the tribes of the giants that the Jews named. There was a tribe that worked with David, of David and Goliath days.
Gibberish.
David, yes, the Gibberim. They were not only tall and strong, but very fast and very intelligent, and there were ostensibly about 600 of these that worked with David, which was quite a bit smaller than the armies that faced David or that were chasing David, and yet they feared David and would not face him directly because these Gibberim could hack whole armies to pieces. They could run faster than horses. They could cleave a man in two with a single blow, and they were loyal to David. They had made a choice not to follow the Nephilim.
Interesting. Yeah, here's the, I found a note that wasn't online before about Robert. What he had said was, I guess William Henry said that he'd worked, was working on a theory that the great houses in Chaco Canyon were inhabited by giants who were serviced by the ancient Anasazi, though archaeologists believe that the area was inhabited by the Anasazi alone. And he wrote that he had been lecturing in Florida, California, Toronto, and Arizona. And while in Arizona, he had a chance to compare notes with the renegade theologian Father Charlie Moore, and a most enlightening encounter with a true Anunnaki scholar. Then he had spent some time with Robert Three-Eagle, who blew his imagination wide open with his chronicles of the grave sites, the 10 to 12 foot tall Anunnaki in the Four Corners area. So that's William Henry. Yeah, Three-Eagle is pretty reclusive. You know, you won't find him doing interviews. He did do the book, and this is a guy who knows where they're buried. You know, so
yeah. Well, we have also discovered grave sites all over the world, not only in Utah, but Florida and Montana and Australia and Japan. There have been the bones of these of giants, and all of these traits are common. These six fingers and toes, multiple rows of teeth, and we're not just talking double rows, maybe five or six rows. One of the unique things about the Jibrum is that their language was actually unspeakable by humans. It was more like dolphin. A human just can't make those kinds of sounds. We just don't have the oral cavity and the multiple rows of teeth with which to do so. And of course, our brains for our body size are larger than most animals, not as big as a whale's, but the giants and the Nephilim, their brains are larger than ours and have a lot more aptitude. That is to say, they've been exposed to higher technology than we have. We, I guess, proudly think that we're the only advanced civilization that's ever lived upon the Earth. One of the things we do decisively in the book is we explain that just simply isn't true. There have been other civilizations on this Earth that have advanced as far, maybe even farther than we have, and they may have even mastered the ability to travel to other planets.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, this is Will Bluehour speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony, so it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease. Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
Well, do you think that their descendants were the race known as the Sea Kings?
That seems to point toward the common origin. What we have here on the Earth, when Atlantis and Mu were above the surface of the ocean, they were quite large and advanced. They also seemed to progress to a point where they could inflict global warfare upon one another. And there's evidence going back about 25,000 years of nuclear warfare occurring. We have excavated sites that actually have whole streets of people laid out, holding hands in the framework of running away from something as a family, and their bones are more radioactive today than those victims that were recovered from Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
That's amazing. So you're telling me their bones are radioactive?
Yes, the bones are still more radioactive today than those recovered from Ground Zero, from Hiroshima. So there was a thermonuclear war, or a weapon, that went off in those days, and it laid waste to an entire region of humanity.
Well, you'd be talking about something pretty high up on the atomic chart or the periodic chart, because the half life of it'd have to be a half life of what?
Well, the half life of plutonium is 12,000 years.
Yeah,
1,500 years. So, but that's only half.
Yeah.
So, anything that would have been irradiated by that, the daughters of those species would still be active. I have held sand in my hands from ground zero, from the first atomic test, when I did my postdoc work at Oak Ridge. I actually held sand in my hands, and I put it in a gamma spectrometer and looked at the species of isotopes that was left in that sand from that very first blast.
My parents lived out behind the country club at Oak Ridge. My dad worked for DOE there, and when were you at Oak Ridge?
94 to...
Oh, really?
98.
Well, I'll be darned. Yeah, they were there then, too. He was in and out of there ever since the mid-70s.
It's a big community.
Oh, it is. It's huge. It's absolutely huge. But go ahead. I didn't mean to get tangential on you.
No, that's all right. Well, the point that I was trying to make is that there have been civilizations upon the Earth that have progressed as far as we have, and remarkably enough, as luck would have it, actually it wasn't luck that they developed weapons and they fought each other and destroyed each other. Now, you would think, gosh, how do races like this communicate? Why do they follow this common path? Is it just the nature of humans that, we're such predators that we're going to follow this path over and over and over again on our own? We maintain that that's not true. We maintain that even the evil that we see here on our planet now, it almost seems as though they get up in the morning, and I don't want to go all the way back maybe even to medieval times with the Gauls and Marco Polo, although he was a great explorer, Genghis Khan, all of these conquerors. It's almost as if they had a fax machine from Evil Central, and they were all getting the same direction. They used the same methods of torture, the same methods of repression. We see it in South Africa, and certainly in Uganda, and it's just horrible things that we would never conceive of on our own. So where does this common origin of debauchery and heartless murder and seemingly unfulfilled hunger for world domination and repression of everything else.
Oh.
It comes from the Nephilim. That's what they teach us. That's what they teach the leaders. And so you have to wonder, the leaders that we have today, at least by recorded history that we put some stock in, they've got more power than any recorded history that we have.
Yep.
They've got the ability to literally destroy every living thing on the surface of the earth with their weapons. What restrains them? This mutually assured destruction that we balanced the earth with and had some measure of peace for a quarter of a century. Who made that balance? Who created that? Why did they race down that pathway and then pull back? And you really want to ask the question, what are they doing now? What are the Nephilim doing now with the leaders of the world to bring this world under their dominion?
Well, if these are the last days, then you've got that prophecy that, as it were in the days of Noah, so it would be in the latter days. So you've got the same kind of setup.
Do we see the institution of marriage and the holiness of a father and a mother and children being bound together for eternity? Do we see that institution assaulted in our society today?
Yeah, you also see abductions going on.
Sure we do. We see the same thing that our ancient brothers saw and wrote down on cave walls and on plates and on parchments. We see the flying craft. We realize that there's some other life form on this planet that travels around in a way that we don't travel, making right-hand turns at 40,000 miles an hour and things like that. We can't do that. We don't have any craft that do that. Where do they live? Why are they here? What are they doing? And I have a good friend. His name is Granville Angel, and he's a psychologist who lives in North Carolina, wrote a great book called The God-Shaped Hole. And he has interviewed literally thousands upon thousands of these people that have been abducted. And he hears the same story over and over and over again. Teachers and policemen and construction workers and rabbis, and it's unbelievable.
I've been convinced for some time that when you look at Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and we're now in the part of the vision, the ten toes. Now these toes, some of them were iron and the other were miry clay. So I'm convinced that there's an unseen kingdom on this earth that's going along with the kingdom of iron that we have right now. There's something we don't see that's there.
Sure, but still, I may be making an assumption here that the population of this race that we're talking about cryptically right now is far less than the population of mortal man upon the planet now. And I'd venture to say that even if a 9-footer stepped out from behind some secret wall and said, I am an intergalactic traveler and I'm here to take me to your leader, it's a pretty safe bet. We would not accept that person as a god or an angel. We're pretty proud people.
Mm-hmm.
We would just call a spade at that point. So this minority population upon the earth, no matter how intelligent they are, could never subdue us by force. They would have to do it by skill. They would have to do it by economics.
Yeah.
You were saying that the signs of the times were coming to be. One of the signs that appears in Revelations cryptically is this mark of the beast or sign of the beast. And, you know, we think of it as maybe a brand or a tattoo, but actually it would have a function. And the function would be to assure irrefutably our identity as individuals. Now, how often have you heard in the news, well, let's just say over the last 5 years or 10 years, the concept of identity theft?
Oh,
it's probably one of the hottest things in technology today.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's the 666 matrix. I can't remember the name of the woman in Alabama years ago that when the UPC code came out, she drew the conclusion. Before they started messing with the code, it was pretty easy to draw the conclusion that it had something to do with 666. Now, oddly enough, 666 actually has more to do with Solomon's seal, probably, than it does with John's revelation, because they're realizing now that there are new, there are other scrolls that come out that have shown that numerology that John was messing around with was actually 616. And everybody's kind of afraid of this 666 thing, but people don't realize that that Solomon had 666 talents of gold and silver. Now, why that number? So, I mean, it's definitely there. It's just...
I'm not so much into the numerology.
Yeah.
But you know, when we started writing this next volume that's coming out in January, it's just the Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, and part of what was left out of Volume 1, is we started, I guess, realizing what the strategy is and how it would be implemented. You know, my generation, or even my parents' generation, would never relinquish our freedom of anonymity to a seal or to a barcode or a chip under the skin or anything to irrefutably identify ourselves. But my children would probably accept that.
Oh, sure.
And you would think, well, gee, you know, why would they do that? Well, think about the mechanics of it. When you go into a grocery store and you want the discount, the first thing that you scan when you go up to the electronic scanner is a little barcode that's associated with your name and your address and your age and your race and things like that, so that they know who's buying the orange juice, who's buying the ice cream and the bologna. And it's valuable data. I agree with you. Merchants that produce that want to know who's buying the orange juice, what's the demographic, how do we design our advertising. And this, and they pay the stores for this information, and that's why you get the discount on the groceries. But the profiling software that creates this picture of society in your area where you're using this barcode, that's the important thing. And then take it to the next generation where we have this magnetic strip on a card. We call a debit card or a bank card. And it's very convenient. You can go anywhere. I can go to Arby's and buy a roast beef with my debit card now. Uh-huh. I can rent cars, buy airplane tickets, do anything I want to do. I have total access to my money. And, in fact, it's become so convenient, I have to admit, I don't carry cash much anymore.
Oh, me neither.
So, the freedom that cash gives us, that I've now converted my labor, whether I'm an engineer or I mow grass, I've converted my labor into a green piece of paper that I can exchange for anything in the world. That's tremendous freedom. And I can pretty much walk in anywhere. I don't have to ask, do you accept cash? Unless I'm renting a car, they don't accept cash, but everybody else does. And so I can anonymously convert my labor into anything I want without repudiation. But if I use my debit card and I buy something I shouldn't, it could be traced to me.
Oh, sure.
So now you have this dual culture that's come about in our world. It seems as though the people that want to remain anonymous are criminals.
Yeah.
They're shipping in bales of cash to buy things, weapons, drugs, terrorism, you name it. Cash is the currency of evil. And so the sales job that's being done is so skillful and so global. It's like an orchestra. We have the euro that's consolidated all of these ancient currencies. We have the dollar that's very powerful in the world. And it will not be long before these currencies coalesce into one currency. For a couple of reasons. We want to get rid of the exchange rate, we want to balance trade, you name it. And then that currency, as far as cash, it's going to go away. It costs too much to print, it's too easy to counterfeit, and we don't want bales of it coming across our borders or going out of our borders to pay for cocaine and heroin that comes back into our borders. We want to eliminate all that. In short, what we want to do is we want to monitor every single purchase. To keep you free, to keep you safe. We don't want drugs in our country. We don't want weapons. We don't want armies formed with cash.
Back in 81, they were talking about the fourth generation computer, and they said that at that time they were in fourth generation computers, but they said a new fifth generation computer, I believe that in 82, I guess it was, had been created. And that this thing floated, and it was about the size of a basketball, floated in a vat of helium, I believe they said, and was able to monitor 500 million transactions per second, and was artificially intelligent, you know, plug itself in for a snack and so forth and so on. So they've got the technology, and they've got the chip, and I guess they're making refinements on the chip now.
Well, yes. Let me just give you a rundown on the advancement in computer technology. When I started in computers I used them. I didn't work on them. I was at a university in Southern California, and I was doing some genetic study. And we had a computer in our department. It was rather large. It took up, a couple thousand square feet. And it used 2-inch tape. And I remember the factory rep coming in and upgrading our RAM. He came in and he finished the upgrade, which took all day. And he said, I have now upgraded this computer to 8K of RAM. No computer will ever need any more than 8K of RAM. This is the most advanced computer in the world. Oh, we laugh now, but that was big stuff then. You know, we
was that back in 76? Was that back in 76? That was my Commodore had more RAM than that.
So now this computer that I'm looking at on my desk right now, it has a gig and a half of clock speed. I have a gig of RAM. I know this is the kind of computer that we would launch a probe to the moon with in those days.
Yeah.
So the power
and it'd be the size of the room.
Exactly. I carry it in my black bag
on
the airplane. So the technology is there. The point that I'm trying to make is that the source of this knowledge. Occasionally, and I've read some biographies of mathematicians who have learned all the known math. They get to a point where their brains realize that there's something missing. I need to continue this line that I'm drawing or this curve that I'm imagining, and I don't have enough math to do it. And in each case, they reach their spiritual hand out into the maelstrom of knowledge out in the universe. And they pull something down. Pure knowledge is poured into their brain, and we make a leap forward.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of wisefoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies. Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain. Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfast and 10 delicious dinner entrees from wisefoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year's supply from wisefoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingram, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why.
And it doesn't matter whether it's Einstein or whether it's Maxwell or Newton. The story is the same. Although in some cases they claim to be atheists, they also claim that there is some higher source of knowledge that they reach out to and receive. And if that knowledge is out there for us to collect, then it has always been out there. And that means that somebody out there knows it. They can be good or they can be evil. You can use the knowledge for good or for evil. So if you were a world leader and you had as your advisor an intergalactic, ageless traveler who said, this is what we need to do next in order to ensure that your country maintains its dominance over the world or gains dominance over the world. And sort of like puppeteers, they pull a string. They give another tidbit of information, and you make another leap forward. Not too far, just enough to maintain things off balance. Because if we made too much of a leap, then we would rule the world, you know, without measure. And they don't want that. They want this balance, this constant threat of annihilation to be maintained, because they know odds are eventually some man is going to go insane and push the button.
Yeah.
And then the population of the planet is reduced again, and the mission of the Creator is thwarted again.
Mm.
But I honestly believe, and I think most people that I speak with on your level, they believe this too, that there's a metamorphosis that we're on the threshold of as a race. We are very close. If we made the choice, we have finally discovered that there's enough energy, there's enough land, there's enough food, there's enough water for everyone. We don't have to hoard it to ourselves anymore. We are almost at this point where we don't have to have people die of poverty anymore on this planet. Now, that means that we're also going to have to rise above the mentality of a rat, which is, as long as there's plenty of food and some place to live, I'm going to have children. And so we just flood the earth with life, and we end up killing ourselves from overpopulation. We could reach a balance where there's enough life for everyone, and everyone that is alive can have life.
Well, yeah, sure. This was the whole message that Rabbi Yehoshua, the man that has come to be known as Jesus, his message was that you live all things common. Gandhi said that if there were no greed, there would be no need.
But that doesn't mean that everybody has to live off of a bowl of rice.
No. When you go into this system, you get richer collectively than you ever would have been individually. People don't realize this, that every time and every instant that this has happened, in the history of the world, and there have only been a few, that you get rich. Unfortunately, you know, after a couple hundred years, you know, you get so rich that you get people that get ideas of that are non-egalitarian, and they want to start dressing more fancy and doing other things other than the rest of the group.
Sure, we see that cycle from within the group, but we also see victimization from outside the group. There have been groups, Jews, Indians, Mormons, whatever, that work together, that try to share the wealth of the community, and they feed it back into the community. Mm-hmm. And what you realize is, hey, where did that big city come from with paved streets and brick homes and schools and music, and we don't have that. Why do they have that? And then there's this jealousy, and so they just go burn the place to the ground. But you do have to wonder, where does the leadership come from that keeps repressing these pockets of metamorphosis where the human race has realized, hey, we don't have to fight. We can actually get along. We can actually feed one another, help one another, share our skills with one another. Where does the desire to repress that come from? And how do you do it to a globe? And we were talking about technology earlier. This computer I have on my desk and the one with which you're recording this broadcast uses binary logic, ones and zeros. What would happen if we went to trinary logic? Instead of on and off, you now have off, neutral, and on, or minus one, zero, and plus one.
Yeah.
What would happen? Well, now you don't have just, you know, two states, you have three. And if you do a little bit of factorial math, you realize now you have six permutations instead of two. That changes everything.
Yeah, it sure does. That sure does.
That technology is there. But, like the printing press, we can't just come out with an inkjet printer and put the printing press out of business. We've got too much invested in printing presses.
Yeah.
But it will happen.
Sure it will.
And it'll start with those that want the better weapons first, and then it'll trickle down to us.
Yeah. Well, you know, they've got rumors I kind of wonder who this Maitreya guy is, because he's...
I've heard the name, seen the pictures.
Supposedly been, you know, witness to materialize and dematerialize in front of a large group of people. I mean, if a guy like this was coming in out of the White House and, you know, got the ear of the president or whoever, you know, and, you know, there's all kinds of things that be going on that we don't know about.
Well, now you take the knowledge that we've put in the book and you make the jump, which is what we want our readers to do. We want our readers to draw their own conclusions. We're not taking any sides. We're not alarmists. We're not trying to paint a picture of doom or despair. What we're trying to do is empower our readers so that they not only realize that they are a spiritual being having a mortal experience, but that their potential is absolutely unlimited. They are not limited to being a mortal subservient. They can transcend. And they can do it in a real way. We have the right, we have the intelligence, and I think more than ever before, we have the opportunity.
Sure. Jesus said, you know, all these things you see me do, and even greater, you know, you can do. And so,
but what did he use as his examples? Were they complex? Were they
unimaginable? Very simple.
Yeah, very simple.
Spit in mud. What he worked with.
Yeah, wolves and goats and sheep and dust and storms and, you know, simple, and he never traveled more than, 60 miles from his home?
Yeah, that's what they say.
And yet, 20 centuries later, here we are, considering his words once again.
Still trying to figure him out. Yeah. Well, you know, the Dead Sea Scroll 4QMMT, which was finally deciphered by Professor Alicia Qimron, shows that, you know, a lot of people are waking up to the fact that his name wasn't Jesus, that was a construct that was laid over by the Hellenized Romans, because one of their gods was Zeus, but his name was Rabbi Yehoshua. And he just called his movement the Way. But we now have more scientific, logical information about him than we've ever had before. And that logic and information really is going to show that rather than himself being a god or a god man, he was just a human being like we are. And that brings these miracles even closer to us. Matter of fact, if you believe Torah, Messiah cannot be and could not ever claim to be deity, and could only be a human being.
But could be the son of deity as we are.
Yeah, the prophecies were that he would be called Son of God, but he when he was asked directly, you know, he never really said who he was. He said he was the resurrection, and that definitely. But now we have proof because we know in the context of the time, because the head of the Sanhedrin at the time, before his time, could give the kind of ordination that he was historically given. But during that period of time, it could be given by the head of the Sanhedrin, but only with the approval of Sanhedrin. So he was a real ribby. You know, he couldn't have had the following unless he kept Torah and taught Torah without any reservations. Mm-hmm. But he was a human being. The idea that he was some kind of a god actually was laid over between 135 and 333, but he definitely had. He was able to work miracles, and so when he said, "All these things you see me do, you can do it even greater." Once the world realizes he wasn't a god, he was a human being, that we could do these things too. And of course, this is heresy to Christians and agreeing with Jews, but. Now we've got more of a historical record now. Not many people know about it because the Dead Sea Scrolls have been suppressed. But the information is there. We can now find that we can do these things. We just have to put our minds.
Well, you're exactly right in the sense that he performed miracles and never came out and said, look, these things that I do are far beyond your reach.
Mm-hmm. He never did.
And you will never be able to do what I do. Mm-hmm. He never said that.
Mm-hmm.
What he said was, I am exposed to the same temptations that you have been,
mm-hmm.
but I have not fallen to the temptation.
Right.
I have overcome all the temptations.
Right. Well,
so therefore, I lived my life, and I'm going to use a more esoteric word. I've lived my life without sinning. I've chosen consciously not to sin every
mm-hmm.
time the choice was put before me. So the concept that somebody had to open the portal of resurrection, that no one had ever been resurrected before, and that there had to be a first. And in order to be a first, you had to have certain qualifications. And one of those
sure.
was that you had to be absolutely sinless. Somewhere in your life, you had to be exposed to everything, not cloistered virtue, mind you, but real virtue. You had to be exposed to all of the evil in the world and overcome it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would be worthy to establish the resurrection and make a way for the rest of us.
He was definitely different. If you read Ron Wyatt's archaeological work about discovering the Ark and actually finding a cave that contained the Ark and found out that there was a cross hole, that there was a black substance dripping from the ceiling down onto the box that the Ark was in, and that 20 feet above that chamber was a cross hole on Skull Hill. You know, so anyway, long story made short, you know, they did the work on the blood and found out that he was a haploid. In other words, he didn't have any male DNA. He had all female DNA, which is supposedly impossible. But there have been others recently that have had that didn't have, you know, both kinds of chromosomes. So you know, he was a little bit different. So yeah, the whole idea that he may have been born differently. I mean, that's within scientifically within the realm of possibility because. You know, they've got kids. They've got kids that are being born today. There was a young boy named Cohen that was born in a similar fashion, but not quite as interestingly as Jesus was apparently.
And there was another whose legend is mentioned in the scriptures and also in other books. And his name was Melchizedek.
Yeah. And there were also others in the pagan pagan traditions also. Well, without mother, without father, and
mm-hmm. without end of days.
Yeah, what Christians have in the King James Bible is actually pretty
antiseptic.
Well, yeah, you know it's like Rabbi Mikhail Shlomo Baron told me. He says, you know, when you read about people in the Bible, there might be one or two mentions of the guy, maybe one or two sentences. He says, well, we've got volumes of information about who they were.
Sure.
And, you know, actually they'll tell you, oh, well, you know, Melchizedek, so that was Shem. And then they have another explanation for the, you know, without mother, without father, and so forth. And
mm-hmm. Well, there are several ancient legends. And
well,
we,
you know, I mean,
we can get into the armor match of where
there
really is no such book as the Bible. The Bible is just Latin for biblio, meaning library.
Oh, absolutely.
So who decided what books would be in it and what books wouldn't be in it? And of course, you can say, well, I've heard all the arguments of, well, the books that made it in it are the ones that were supposed to be in it, and yeah. But
well, the Old Testament, you know, being the Torah and the Tanakh, I mean, that was something that was. You know, laid by them by the law and the prophets, and
sure.
and what was added later, you know, can be brought into a lot more question because of the nature, the whole nature of the way it was decoded and transposed and translated and so forth. So, but you're right. There's a lot of things we don't know about.
You know, when we were doing our research independently, of course, I haven't known EJ all of my life. I did my research for 20 years and just, you know, filled banker's boxes with it and said, gee, someday I'll publish. And EJ explored pyramids and caves and ruins down in South America and southern Mexico, and she didn't know what she was going to do with her knowledge either. But in 2003, actually it was late 2002, I was giving a lecture on the speed of light, and she attended, and at the end of that she approached me and said, I've got an idea for a book. And we sort of compared our notes and the pathway of our lives, and I said, you know what, that's really not a bad idea. So we hashed out an outline, and this book emerged. And then, over the next 2 years, the writing of this book was the most incredible spiritual experience I've ever had in my life. I'm telling you, I'm brought to tears when I think about it. I'm humbled to the dust, because it almost seemed as though our hands were guided as we put these chapters together. We realized that we had the makings of the most comprehensive book ever written on the creation of the earth. And then we had no idea this was going to happen. November of 2003, there is this planetary alignment called the Grand Sextile Alignment, which occurred in November of 2003. And it was this alignment of six planets, one of them is Chiron, which is actually a large asteroid, but astrologically people consider it a planet. So it formed a Star of David above the Earth. And in this event, this particular night, there was a full lunar eclipse. So we did some research, which is not hard to do with the electronic library we have at our fingertips, and we realized that this has not happened since the heralding of the birth of Solomon, and that there are several prophecies associated with this astrological alignment, one of which hit us like a brick, which was, when this sign occurs, there will be the restoration of lost knowledge about the creation that will be published. And it humbled us to the dust, because we thought, this couldn't be. There is no way that we, a couple of researchers, have done this. And symbolically, we put that planetary alignment along with the flaming Star of David on the cover of the book, so that those familiar with this prophecy would pick the book up and give it a read.
Well, are you aware of the prophecy about Kima, which is the Pleiades, and that the Jewish sages said that someday two of the stars in the Pleiades would be moved to form Star of David? And are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of that.
That's
prophecy.
That'd be,
but
of course, that would shake everybody up.
The stars. I know what it would take to move the stars.
Oh yeah,
the black hole.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I mean, that if something like that happened, it definitely it wouldn't be as strange as the astrological configuration you're talking about. This would be something that everybody could see in the sky. It's an ancient. Ancient writing of Torah sages, they predicted a change in the constellation of Pleiades.
Would that be like unto the sign of the Son of Man?
Well, I don't know. It's just, if they're correct, and Jesus' predictions come to pass, the world will shortly see it, this dramatic sign, two stars in Kima, and that's also known as the seven candlesticks in the Book of Revelations. They are to be moved from their place to form Kokav David in the early pre-dawn sky. Now, exactly when this would occur is not certain, but we do have some clues if we go by historical events that caused the two stars earlier to be removed from their place. Now, the references can be found in more than a dozen places in the Jerusalem Talmud, 10 places in the Babylonian Talmud, 16 places in Rashi's commentary to the Babylonian Talmud, in 16 places in the Tosefta to the Babylonian Talmud. There's a cryptic reference to the constellation Kama as the, guess what, sign of the coming of the Son of Man. and then at you know, Gospel of Matthew. Now, especially when you know, you start thinking about after the people of Israel were allowed to go back and reoccupy their own land, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's, and now the temple incense has been found, and then you've got, there's a prophecy that goes along with that. Now, as of a few weeks ago, the copper scroll was discovered in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was the only metal scroll, and it was translated. That led to the discovery of the ashes of the red heifer, one of the 22 remaining juglets of holy anointing oil that was mixed and made by Moses, 21 of which are inside the ark. And there's and also the ashes of red heifer. Oh yeah, the temple incense was found. Now, all they needed now is the ark itself and the rest of the temple furnishings and the vestments, and they can start. And they're already starting talks about setting up,
restoring the temple.
Well, the tabernacle first.
I see.
It'd be very simple to set up tabernacle. But see, the first thing they're going to undertake is getting the sacrifices going again, because I think they all realize that, even the Orthodox Jews realize that that unless periodically you do at least water sacrifice, then I understand there's a something called corpse defilement. So in order for them to be fully living Torah, they've got to start up the sacrifices again. So this is what they're talking about right now. And then, you know, they realized that they could probably rebuild the entire temple, including all its inner courts and outer courts, and still have about 60 feet between the outer wall and the walls for the Dome of the Rock. So a lot of exciting
again, the sons of Levi come forward.
Yeah, well, they're forward, and now they've got it's DNA. There's a Cohen haplotype that they've identified. It's very easy, and they found that 90% of people who have been told all their lives are Cohens are actually Cohenim, which is a real testament to the the loyalty of their wives, because, you know, even if you had a little messing around, you know, you have a
right,
lot.
Right, exactly.
The 90%. Boy, there's some exciting things going on. And then, you know, you've actually got this discovery of Dead Sea Scroll 4QMMT and the scholarship of Clint Van Nest.
Then you've got the Nag Hammadi library, discovered and then scattered throughout the black market, and then some of it was recovered, and then these were actually copper scrolls that were found in goat caves in Nag Hammadi, and they were cut apart. Somebody finally figured out how to do it. They cut it apart with a water saw, and then put the pieces of the scrolls back together. But the translations, and I've read even the most modern one, is cut into pieces. Translated by uninspired men, and so the literal language that was used in those days was translated as directly semantically into English as possible, but
mm-hmm.
the meaning, the flavor, the point that they were trying to make in many cases was lost.
Well, you can't translate. One of the problems with the New Testament is you can't translate Semitic concepts very well into Greek, much less into Greek and into English.
Yeah.
But now they're realizing that all these 2,000 years we've been told that the Pharisees were the problem. They weren't. Actually, what happened was a group of priests bought the control of the temple. They took over the Sadducee text. The real Sadducees were actually Zadokites. They went into the desert to Qumran and started writing, this teacher of righteousness is the person who wrote 4QMMT that explained what was going on at the time in the light of the times. So people are beginning to reason, hey, you know, the Pharisees had a bad rap. Jesus himself was a Pharisee. He was ordained. He had a right to teach. He had a large following, and everything just kind of got lost in the shuffle, because under the law of Moses, there is a way for Gentiles to worship, and they're only required to keep seven commandments rather than 10. But, you know, after the temple was destroyed in 71, things just kind of got out of control and got really, the teachings really got marred, and you got some things laid over. But the exciting thing is the original records of the Nazarene or Nazarene sect have been restored. And you can now study those. And there is so much exciting that's going on right now. It's just, it's an explosion. Absolutely.
Oh, it is. And I don't expect the vast population of the world to go out and try to buy these ancient texts and read them and pray about them and do as much research as you and I have done. But, you know, when we published the book, we realized it wasn't complete, so we're trying to get Volume 2 done. We thought that we could, in literary style, in a way that people could read it and understand it, we even double-spaced the book to make it easy for people to understand, that maybe we could publish a work that not only would be timeless, but would help people who, no matter what religion they are, and I've gotten fan mail from all kinds of different people, that they have reached an impasse in their own church and their own religion.
Oh, yeah.
And they were considering, you know, becoming a religious or forming their own church, or they go to church every Sunday, but they're not really there because they realize that there's just so much more than what's being preached every single Sunday. And they read the book and they say, this is the piece. This is what I was looking for. I'm going to go back and I'm going to read the Bible again because I knew this was there, and they're excited about it, which pleases me much more than my publisher telling us that they have 20,305 authors and we're the number one selling authors. I was pleased to hear that, but I'm more pleased when I receive very personal letters from people that say,
yeah,
you know, thank you for bringing me back from the brink of ignominy. I now understand who I am and what I can become.
Well, thanks to the explosion, you know, books like the ones you publish and the explosion of information we now have going on, you know, what the Bible describes as the restoration of all things spoken of all the mouths of all the holy prophets.
Mm-hmm.
I want to put in a plug for a new friend of mine, Clinton Van Nest, who was a former Baptist preacher that rediscovered the Nazarene sect and the original religion from Dead Sea Scrolls and other sources, and he has reconstructed the Book of Matthew. And I recommend you also, Dr. Agnew, Netzarim, Netzarim .co.il. This is the
.il
Israel. Netzarim.
Okay.
.co.il, the Restored Nazarene Jews of Israel, and these are Orthodox Jews who have put together the original historical Rabbi Yehoshua, who is actually the polar opposite of the post 135 Christian counterfeit, to show you. And it wasn't, when I say Christian, I mean the pagan Romans. You know, they brought their idea in of God, man, and so forth and so on. And anyway, it's a fascinating read to go in and see what really happened and how much information they really got that's concrete, it's scientific, it's logical, and it helped people maybe come to the realization that, hey, Jesus may be more human than we even thought, and that if he can do it, we can too.
That's exactly right. That's it's not that we are abasing Jesus in any way. What we are really trying to do is understand the possibility of the exaltation of man.
Exactly. Well, you know, I mean, Jesus said, you know, and any way you look at it, he upheld the Torah. He had to have. There was no other way. He had a very, very narrow set of circumstances to teach. But the thing that he did introduce was the revolutionary thought that you remember the, you know, the old saying that the Sadducees didn't believe in the resurrection.
Resurrection.
That you see, you know, this was the thing that was raging at the time in Jerusalem, and they had a lot of people running around saying they were the Messiah, but only one person had actually resurrected somebody from the dead, and it's recorded in the Book of John that the Sanhedrin got together, which they never did, but they got together over this, and they said, what are we going to do? Jesus has just resurrected this guy from the dead, and everybody's wondering what they're going to do, and then so Caiaphas stands up and says, hey, you guys don't know anything. If he really is the Messiah, then he needs to die for the people, and then it goes on to say from that point forward they determined they were going to kill him, and you know, that would explain why, you know, they were hailing him with hosannas coming down on the according to the prophecy of Meshua or Messiah
Palm Sunday.
Palm Sunday, and a few days later they're screaming for his blood, but what they were saying was, crucify him, let his blood be upon us.
And upon our generation.
Right, right. And so, I mean, it was just totally missed the point. And he said he only came to the lost sheep of house of Israel, and I mean, those people were the people that left 1,000 years before was born, the northern kingdom, and went off, and they were Hosea. It points out that those dispersed of Israel that never came back, even though they got, I mean, four heralds were sent out to invite them to come back, and they were butchered and sent back in pieces. But
well, he also said, in his resurrected form, other sheep I have,
sure,
are not of this fold.
Exactly.
Them also must I bring.
But they became all the nations of the earth. God said to those, to the lost sheep, he said, you're not my people, I'm not your God, I'm going to scatter you all over the earth. And yeah, other incidences with the tribe of Benjamin, they know that they became the Norse, you know, the Normans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Phoenician boats, Viking boats are basically identical to Phoenician boats. And there's so much more now that's known now. But, you know, his mission really didn't have anything to do with Jews, because they hadn't screwed up to the point that all the rest of the 10 tribes had screwed up to, which they had. The rest of the 10 tribes had screwed up to the point where they became Gentiles. And once they became Gentiles, and he was able to bring them back in, it opened the door for the entire world to come be a part of that family of Israel.
Sure. When Moses left Egypt with the inhabitants that he led away,
including
there was a mixed multitude,
yeah,
with them.
That's who the tribes of Israel descend from. It's that.
Sure.
Well, you know, you got to remember Joseph in Genesis. Basically, the Jews, they got the right to interpret the law. They got the scepter, and Joseph's descendants got everything else. They got all the rest of the blessings, but.
Well, they also maintained their genetic purity, and they didn't
mix
with the Nephilim or their descendants.
Right.
And, so they the blessings that went with keeping that purity also pass along to their present population.
But Joseph's people and the other tribes, they went worldwide.
Sure,
they went worldwide, and
yeah, the tribe of Joseph, which is the root of Jesse, they traveled across the world, and. Their sons, Manasseh, Ephraim.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they had two other sons, but I think they had some more sons.
Yeah, Ephraim, Manasseh, and then because of the incident with Joseph's divining cup, Benjamin became part of the house of Joseph. And but you know, the tribes are starting to come back in, and just as prophesied, they're coming back in the reverse order that they left in. So the first. Manasseh. Manasseh has come back in.
Yes.
They've come back in from India, and now they have tribes in Afghanistan that have never lost their tribal names. They've never lost their festivals and their identity, their tribal identity. And Rabbi Mikhail was telling me that he attended a funeral with some of these people. Of course, they moved into the most dangerous area of Israel on the West Bank. He says these people are so hardcore, anyway, he goes to this funeral, and there's women around, you know, and he's saying, where's the men, you know? And
They said,
look up in the trees. There's 50 guys up in the trees with M16s and sniper rifles doing security for the... He says, they're hard. These are Afghanistan guys. They're hardcore. But they're Israel.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, this is Will Blueauer speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony. So it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease. Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
And it's really exciting what's going on, especially with October 13th of last year, the reinstitution of the revival of the Great Sanhedrin, and then the man who dug up those articles that I was telling you about, Wendell Jones, with the help of a friend of mine by the name of Ben Yosef. Ben Yosef found the cave that they discovered the temple incense in, but Wendell Jones found the holy anointing oil and ashes of the red heifer. But he's been given the go-ahead, the blessing of an unnamed Kabbalist, who's, you know, some high-level unnamed Ribby, to go ahead and to look for the Ark of the Covenant, and they're shooting for the middle of August.
Well, our book comes out in January, and we have a whole chapter on the Ark of the Covenant, and we've got some things to reveal that they're gonna change everything.
Well, I don't want to keep you forever. You know, keep talking as long as you want to, but I don't want to keep you too.
Well, that's quite all right. It appears as we've had another unscripted 3-hour radio interview.
But we've done 3 hours in the last hour and a half is what we've done. So.
Yes, but for those people that would like to find the book, you can go to the website arcofmillionsofyears.com, and that's an ark like Noah's Ark. I have people say, I put in ARC and I can't find it. Or, of course, you can go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Books A Million or any of the online booksellers. I think there's about 48 of them that sell the book. Or you can walk into your local Barnes & Noble or Joseph Beth booksellers and pick up the book.
Right, and you can, on our website, of course, from the page that people are listening to, there'll be a link over to your book, or we also have a concession on the website. From the button near the top of the website, it says store.
On our website as well, there's a link to prophecykeepers.com.
Right.
So you can find Bluewater and his work.
This show will be archived for at least a year. So you can just leave a permanent URL up there, and I'll send that URL to you. Basically, the URL is prophecykeepers.com/agnew1.html, and I'll send that to you. And again, that way you can invite folks to come on over here, and we want to have you back.
I would be overjoyed to come back.
You bet.
I can't believe how well this has gone and how eloquent you are and knowledgeable you are, and we would not be, this book would not have sold 5 copies, me and 4 of my friends, if it was not for for shows like yours and the great work that you did, and I want to recognize Mary Sutherland and her work. She's probably the first person that I interviewed with, and she made it easy for us. And,
well, we'd have never gotten our start if it wasn't for Mary.
Yeah, I've told her many times she's the root of just about everybody that's doing these wonderful, just earth-shaking webcasts and bringing truth and knowledge to the world without having to pay homage to major networks.
Right. Well, you know, you'll probably sell 5 copies from this interview.
I doubt it.
Well,
maybe,
you know,
more than that.
We don't have, you know, this we've got to figure out a way, and we're trying to. We're actually losing. We've jumped up 125,000 places from about 224,000 overall to about 99,000 in the rankings of websites. But we've been losing listenership slowly, and it's because we can't afford to. And this is where I'm plugging the show, folks. You know, we're trying to develop this show, and that takes advertising. And what I need to figure out a way to do is get the budget, get another probably about $300 a month, start doing some, you know, pay per click. So what's going to take?
Yeah.
But,
well, I really don't know why. I don't have an explanation for it because I don't do any promotions other than these interviews. But our website gets between 7,000 and 10,000 hits a day. So
well,
I don't know where that ranks. I have
that's
no idea.
And having folks like you on sure it definitely does help us, especially if you leave the link up. And
in 2 weeks I'm going to be in England and Scotland on a book signing tour. I'm being interviewed on a couple
great
of radio stations over there. And again, the book is just selling like wildfire over there.
Oh, that would be great. Well, you know, I figured the best thing I could do is to archive more or less permanent interviews, and that way anybody that comes to your website doesn't have to, you know, oh, gee, I missed him on Coast to Coast. Oh, I can go with Prophecy Keepers and listen to him right now, 24 hours
right.
a day, 7 days a week, 365, and that's what's going to keep us alive. We also ask everybody to pray. We may have a shot to get a one-hour weekly broadcast on Sirius Radio Channel 132, Wisdom Radio. And that's recently been taken over by Steve Case's Revolution. Been rebought. They're going to be rebranded, repackaged. And we may have a shot at this, folks. And this would sure help Prophecy Keepers. And that way, you know, we can get people like you on the phone with listeners. And, you know, Prophecy Keepers could go. This is actually, you know, last August, one of our guests, who is a psychic, said that we'd have problems until after about May, and then he said after that something would happen, and he said Prophecy Keepers would ascend very slowly, and it looks like it's going to happen, but we need your prayers to you know, get Prophecy Keepers on Wisdom Radio.
Well, here we are after May, and it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, we sure appreciate it. Well, Dr. Brooks Agnew, we sure appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you very much, Blue Otter. It's been an amazing experience.
Well, we appreciate you, and we're going to try to get this show up and available for folks here by midnight tonight.
Very good.
All righty.
Thank you so much, and please extend my my well wishes for you to your wife as well.
Yeah, she's getting better.
Make sure that she's doing all right.
Yeah, she had a little, apparently she's had a little problem with her blood pressure, and they adjusted her blood pressure medication, apparently not enough, because she got out in the heat 2 weekends in a row. The second weekend, she almost went blind. This last Sunday, her blood sugar went up about 630 and got to the hospital, and It'll take a while for her to get things under control. We're also getting her on she's a type 2 diabetic. We're putting on a therapy called diabeticine, which is a 99% effective for type 2 diabetics. Diabeticine, something everybody really ought to look into. If you go to diabeticine.com, you can see before and after dark field microscopy of red blood cells before therapy and then 90 days after therapy. With diabeticine, 99% effective for type 2 diabetics. about 64% for type 1. Of course, the reason why people get diabetes is they have problems with the shapes of their red blood cells.
Mm.
So strictly a natural product too. There's a link from the top of the page from prophecykeepers.com, banner link. Well, hey, thanks for being on the show.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Hey, you bet.
Wonderful 4th of July.
And you have a good weekend and a good night's sleep.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, folks. This has been the July 1st, 2005 version of Prophecy Keepers Radio, over and out.
This is Yasa Sagonige, a 7th grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evening and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keepers Preppers Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Let the truth be known. Thank you.